The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Hilary Agro is an anthropology PhD student at the University of British Columbia and a researcher whose studies include drug policy, activism, and the harms of prohibition. She's also the author of an op-ed entitled In Defense of Drug Dealers' Humanity, which was published April 22, 2023 by the Toronto Globe and Mail. We spoke recently via Zoom. Let's start by telling listeners a little more about yourself and your work. What's the focus of your research?
So my current research project is on anti-drug war activism. So basically, most of us are pretty well aware that the war on drugs, is a failure in every way except the way that it's a success, which is lining the pockets of the prison industrial complex. And so the people who are trying to change drug laws and end drug prohibition, you know, as every form of social change that we've ever seen, is it's driven by activists. So whereas my previous research project was about drug use and drug users, now it's more about activism among people who use drugs to change the laws that are impacting them and us.
I think a lot about drug policy, and I've been developing this list of some guiding principles that are mostly based on the work that's going on up in Canada. I'm up to four so far, and they are access to a safe supply, access to safe spaces in which to consume, the decriminalization of people who use drugs, and the decolonization of drug policies. I'm wondering, do you have any thoughts you could share about these? Safe supply is obviously a thing that's actually going on. There's safer supply and safe supply happening up in, that's actually happening up in Canada to some extent.
Oh, goodness. Do I have thoughts? I have a whole PhD's worth of thoughts on the on those things. Yeah. First, I do want to make clear that I think we need to, as drug policy activists and people who talk about this stuff, we do need to be clear with people, because I've noticed that there's a problem these days where, because we're having conversations about decriminalization and legalization, safe supply, just the conversations alone have been enough to trigger reactionaries into lying about what is happening and where. And people also just seem really confused. When I talk about drug legalization, people say, oh yeah, that happened in Portugal. And I'm like, no. We need to be careful here. Drugs are not legal in Portugal. They are decriminalized. And those are two very different things. It's still good that they decriminalize them, but we're not there yet. And I've seen people say, well, you know, San Francisco did safe supply and like, look what's happening there. No, they haven't done any of that. There is very little access to safe supply in Canada. You might be speaking of either some heroin programs that have, you know, there's been pilot programs which have all been super successful. If you're talking about DULF, the Drug User Liberation Front in Vancouver, that is an activist group doing safe supply. Oh, they're doing it. And that is a very interesting development in this work, but it's not sanctioned. What they're doing is illegal. The cops have just decided to not arrest them for it, because basically what they're doing is every month they give out clean, pure, tested heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine in front of the police station in Vancouver. The cops are just choosing to not do anything about it, but it's such a small project that, you know, they don't have the funding. We don't have any real government safe supply programs here in Canada. There's like a couple of small pilot projects, but it's not nearly enough. Thousands and thousands of people have died. Like something like 36,000 people since 2014 have died in Canada of the toxic supply. So while there are activists worth following here in Canada, and there's people who are fighting to do good things, we are in the process of decriminalizing drugs here in Toronto, the province of BC, where Vancouver is located, has decriminalized. But there's a ways to go. But there are some activists doing pretty amazing things.
Yeah, I think of these as goals, more than an actual program. I mean, safe consumption spaces, for example, there are there's the rather somewhat more I guess, somewhat more medicalized and very professional looking thing at Insight that has the, you know, with the,
yes,
this, I mean, I toured the building a couple of decades, a decade and a half ago. My goodness, time does fly. And, you know, it's been a while, but still. But then you have other things like the Overdose Prevention Society, which are more community drop-in spaces. And it's, I get, at least from what I've seen, the, definitely that one I've only seen on the, that brilliant documentary, Love in the Time of Fentanyl. But, well, people use the analogy down here of, to get people there and say, think of a bar. It's like, well, you know, except of course the bartender's selling you drugs and they honestly, they really don't mind if you're doing too much of them. And I've been in bars around midnight and those aren't safe spaces. Those really
depending
are.
On the bar, yeah. Yeah. I mean, at least ostensibly there's some, they are beholden to some rules, like bartenders are supposed to cut people off if they're too intoxicated. But it's still, you know, it's better to have people in bars than in back alleys, right? And yeah, we need to create safe spaces for people to use all kinds of drugs. Which sounds very, very contentious and is, but it just makes sense because if you don't give people safe spaces to use drugs, they will use in unsafe spaces. That's just what's going to happen. But I do think that an interesting thing to bring up here is that while we do have some safe consumption sites in Canada, I mean, they exist in some parts of the US as well. And that's great. And, you know, the primary purpose is overdose prevention, you know, give people access to like healthcare and supplies and everything. And I would also note, importantly, that part of the reason those are able to exist in Canada is because we have socialized healthcare, and so it's cheaper to give people harm reduction supplies and to prevent overdoses, like to give spaces to prevent overdoses, than it is to be dealing with overdoses in hospitals. And so that's one of the effects of socialized healthcare that I think people don't realize when you don't live under a system like this, is when you socialize all the costs, then prevention actually makes sense. We're like, oh, it's very expensive to treat overdoses. Let's prevent people from having them in the first place, which is why there's been some arguments to give people safe supply under the, you know, under healthcare. But any case, I think it's important to get people to start thinking about, you know, even if you're a drug policy person, some people struggle with this. So I'm about to, you know, challenge a worldview, get ready for it to be uncomfortable. We need to not only give people who use drugs a safe place to use those drugs, those environments need to be fun and pleasurable and joyful and nice to spend time in. You wouldn't go to a place to use alcohol if you had to like sit on a little bench in like a white room, you know, with a bunch of nurses there. Some people don't need like the medical environment that is provided at a safe consumption site. What they need is like just a place where they can be around people that they trust, their friends, and use drugs in an environment that's nice. You know, people who have access to alcohol and caffeine get to use their drugs in nice, cozy, welcoming environments where they don't feel stigmatized, criminalized, or medicalized. They're just a person using their drugs among other people who are using the same drugs. Everybody deserves that. People who use psychedelics deserve that. People who use fentanyl and heroin deserve that. They might not even be different spaces. We could just have spaces where people are able to experiment with consciousness alteration. And obviously they should be supplied with everything that they need to keep people safe. But the idea that people who use different drugs only deserve access to these things if they perform the part of an addict or somebody who, you know, is miserable or just a patient or whatever, that's not really solving the problem either, because most people get pleasure from the drugs that they use, and to shame them for wanting to get that pleasure and wanting to like have fun on the drugs that they use is not going to get us anywhere. You can try to shame people all you want. It's very counterproductive, and it's actually going to re-entrench the stigma and the trauma that is causing them to turn to drugs instead of their fellow human beings in the first place. So yeah, we need to create not only safe consumption sites, but fun consumption sites.
Oh, exactly. Well, then, when you medicalized it, the one of the other differences here, it costs a lot of money to get your diagnosis if you're trying to get a substance.
Yes.
I mean, it's going to cost money, and it's, yeah, in addition to humiliating yourself by telling a story. And so, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the safest spaces in which to consume would be home. You know, some four walls and a roof that you can call your own, even if it's a rental. And that's one of the reasons I use the term decriminalization of people who use drugs rather than just decriminalization of drug possession, because we have rules down here that federal assisted housing, people can be kicked out. Oh, families can be kicked out if someone in the household is using controlled substances. And
it's
a federal rule. They'll even, that includes marijuana.
It's crazy making.
Yeah, so they are trying some decriminalization experiments up there, but they're limited. Can you speak to that a moment?
The decrim programs in Canada?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is all very recent, very new. It's very timely for my PhD research that this is all happening, but the province of BC it has recently decriminalized drugs, so they're just kind of figuring out what that looks like. There's some problems with the way the decrim went through. They put a limit on personal amounts that makes no sense. It's just not enough. The city of Toronto, where I live, is currently in the process of decriminalizing as well. So those experiments are important, but it's important to recognize also, because I've seen people, not somebody like you, but people who have different motives for speaking about these things in disingenuous ways. A problem I've seen is people talking about decrim, as an overdose crisis thing. Decriminalization is not addressing the overdose crisis. Legalization and regulation will address the overdose crisis because it will give people access to a safe supply. But what decrim is addressing is the over-policing crisis. And the idea, and it's basically just acknowledging the idea that people should be able to use drugs without risking being thrown in prison or having their kids taken away. So it's really exciting that that's happening finally, and that this stuff is going through, and it's thanks to the work of a lot of, really, really diligent, hardworking activists who have been pushing for this for a really long time. And, I should note also for anybody listening to this that, we need more people in the movement. You have talents and skills, and if you feel, alienated, if you are scared of the way that society is going, and if you spend a lot of time just scrolling on your phone, kind of being afraid, join us. We're doing activism. We are changing things. We are not going to give up on society, and we are actively working to create a better place for everyone to live. And we need everybody's skills on board. No matter who you are, you have ways that you could contribute to these movements. And it feels really good. It feels really good to get stuff done. And people listen when you're coming from a place of compassion and wanting to make your community better. So yeah, join us. I actually have a list of organizing resources on my website if anybody just doesn't know where to start.
Get that website again.
HilaryAgro.com, HilaryAgro.com.
This is my conversation with Hilary Agro, an anthropology PhD student at the University of British Columbia and a researcher whose studies include drug policy, activism, and the harms of prohibition. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I was going to ask you about decolonization, but I'd also like to ask you about, capitalism and any capitalism is, do you know much about that? One of the things about legalization as we've had it happening down here, and just from what I can see up there in Canada, is that the money and the greed that have really, that are really messing up parts of these industries, basically, capitalism seems to be the enemy of equity. How can we resolve that?
Another enormous question. you're asking some great important questions here. I spend my whole life answering this question publicly on social media, along with all of my friends and comrades who are doing the same thing, and basically. It's hard to talk about capitalism because a lot of people don't understand what capitalism is, but it's basically a system where the workers, the people who produce things and do the work at a job, are not getting all of the profit of the work that they do. And the most of the profit of that labor goes to the person who owns the land that the business is situated on or owns the business. And so it's an inherently unequal thing. And also it means that because you can't limit capitalism, like theoretically capitalism could work if we could implement like limits to how much you could earn or extrapolate or extricate from this labor system. But it doesn't work like that, because as long as we're allowing some people to own land, you know, privately, and there's people who need to live on the land who don't own the land and have to like pay landlords to be able to live on it, have to sell their labor to work, you're always going to have people with more money and power, and they can. And even if we, you know, theoretically create a system where we're like, okay, you're not allowed to make more than $1 billion, like, yay, we're going to tax all billionaires above $1 billion at 100%. It won't work like that, because they have enough money in the first place to pay off the politicians that would be implementing those laws, which is why we can't, you know, there's all sorts of ways that we could make capitalism better and make it work for us. But it's literally impossible as long as the system of capitalism allows some people to get more and more and more money, because they will always put that money back into the system to make it so that there is no limit. But I think what it's important to also understand about this system, because there's, you know, there's also on that website that I mentioned, there's a ton of resources if you want to learn more about capitalism and how it functions and how to fight it. But it's one thing that has come out of my work in particular is the fact that we also need to understand that capitalists, like bosses, people who want more and more money and want to pay workers as little as possible so that they can extract as much value and labor from their work as possible so that they can just own lots of, those people are addicted. They are the people with addictions that are the real problems, because they are addicted to watching the numbers go up. We're monkeys, people. We're apes. Like we're human beings. We have a bunch of, you know, physical and emotional needs in order to live well. And beyond a certain amount of money, you are not living better, because there is a limit to what human beings can consume. And so they are addicted to watching these numbers go up. They're addicted to power. They're addicted to the feeling of, you know, nobody can ever treat me or make me feel powerless the way that I felt when I was a kid, when I, you know, it goes back to a lot of trauma stuff and generational trauma. But they just, you know, look at any billionaire. They are not happier than anyone else. They're not $1 billion happier. They are just addicted to power. And we need to understand that and actually even have a little empathy for like, oh, okay, there is no reason for you to want more always. That doesn't make sense, and it's really bad for everybody else, because the way that those people are getting more and more is by paying workers less and by destroying the environment. And so to understand that, oh yeah, you guys have like a brain disease that's causing you to act in this way, we need to respond accordingly. And, you know, people have different opinions about what we should do about capitalism, and I think that everyone should do as much as they can, and there's all sorts of different methods and schools of thought on what we should do about that, but understanding it at least is a first step. And the second step people can do is unionize your workplace.
A very good message there. This is last one of these, the fourth point, which I have to admit I'm only starting to wrap my head around. I've talked to Sean Shelley and I've read quite a bit, some really good stuff out there on the question of decolonization of drug policies. And it's a lot to untangle, really, and its impact on policies. And we're seeing it probably played out more within the psychedelic sphere, but the drug war is based on this colonial thing. If it's a plant that was used by indigenous peoples in the southern hemisphere, we pretty much, it starts out with being banned until someone can prove that there's a way we can make money from it. But like I say, I'm just starting to think about this. Do you have any thoughts about this notion of decolonization of the policies?
Yeah, I have a million thoughts about it. I know we've taken a lot of time, so I'll try to keep them short. But yeah, basically just acknowledging that indigenous sovereignty land sovereignty and cultural sovereignty is important. it's key and it's essential, partly because, you know, in indigenous worldviews, we are not the owners of the land. We are animals who live on the land, who need to live sustainably with the land, and not extract everything unsustainably. Centering that worldview is the only way that we can stop killing the whole planet. Decolonization is pretty important. When it comes to drugs in particular, it's also essential because what colonization and capitalism do is they commodify everything, right? So coca is no longer like a sacred plant, or even just, I mean, not everything has to be sacred, just like a useful plant. It's like a commodity. And when something is commoditized, then it can be monetized. We want to sell it. We want to grow it. We want to exploit it. And that is destroying the environment. Even, you know, our sort of Western urge to like try all of the drugs and like, ooh, if you like psychedelics, then like fly to Peru and do ayahuasca, like do this, do that, go get some peyote from the desert. That is reflective of a colonizer mindset where we just want to consume, 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 instead of realizing like, oh, like how can I live in community with these plants and with the people who are like stewards and caretakers of this plant, actually being able to do these things thoughtfully. And it's decolonization is very important, and we need to have more of those conversations. And I would also really emphasize that people should be listening to Indigenous people on these subjects. I know a lot about it because I read writings by Indigenous people. I listen to Indigenous people. I follow them on social media. That's the only reason that I am in any way qualified to speak about this stuff, is because I've spent a lot of time learning directly from Indigenous people, but that will never truly make me qualified to speak about these things. And so I really strongly encourage people to listen to Indigenous activists, thinkers, scholars, as well as Black activists, thinkers, and scholars, who are also an essential voice in this, and also Latin American voices. Particularly in North America, where we're located. So, yeah.
And the drug worker, that's the other thing that struck me as I was going as I was getting ready for this. It's like, I mean, I don't understand why that should be such a confusing thing for people, especially because we have legal marijuana sales and in so many states. I mean, it's a marijuana business, and you don't just have people selling marijuana. You've also, there's a whole side to it. There's administration, there's logistics, there's transport, there's storage, there's, you know, packaging and weighing. There's all kinds of stuff, the labeling. I mean, obviously, since it's a business, it's a little more, I think, a little more involved. But, you know, when the business was unregulated, I've worked in both, and when it was unregulated, you still had to deal with logistics and transportation and other kinds of stuff. It wasn't just everybody involved in the thing was slinging bags. That's just not how it works. You have people doing different things and different stuff, people whose main gig would be transporting, and they're, you know, traveling from state to state. You have people whose main gig is handling money. You have people whose, I mean, it's a
and
business.
It's work. They're doing labor.
Oh, yeah, and they're usually compensated. You know, I mean, volunteer work is still work. It's a volunteer show. This is still work. But, yeah, I mean, exactly. You would think that would be something that should be a lot easier for people to process, because, after all, these are businesses.
Yeah. I mean, I think it did and does resonate with a lot of people. I think anybody who has worked a job has, you know, an appreciation for the concept of labor. But, you know, Silicon Valley rich people have never worked a real day in their lives. So it makes sense that they balk at the idea of workers like us talking about what it means to work, and including more people under that definition so that we can build solidarity with our fellow workers. But yeah, I mean, it's like you mentioned the quote that I had about that it's uncomfortable for people to challenge their biases. And I think that's really important, because we have to acknowledge that people feel very unsafe and unstable, and it can feel really uncomfortable to be like, okay, I have this conception, I have this worldview, drug dealers are bad, you know, and that's a safe, nice little worldview to have. some people, like, you know, you and I and many people are okay with having our worldviews challenged because we find pleasure in that. We're like, oh, I never thought about things that way. That's really interesting. We like to have our worldviews challenged because maybe you won't agree with it, but you feel like your worldview can stand up to challenge. And when you change your worldview, it's not going to, you know, make your whole life crumble to pieces. But if you feel so, if your sense of self isn't very strong, if you're, you know, on the top of a power pyramid, for example, any challenge and threat to your worldview can be very, very destabilizing and make people feel very uncomfortable. So the idea of like challenging what somebody, you know, the stereotypes that somebody believes about drug workers, they balk, they resist, they go like, no, you're wrong, because they just don't want to have to challenge anything about their worldview because it's so fragile. And that's unfortunate, but it's something that needs to be factored into these conversations because, you know, got to have empathy for people in those situations too. I get it. It's uncomfortable. You know, I go through this a lot, even with well-meaning progressive people who have started to buy into like the anti-trans rhetoric. And they're like, I don't know, I have some questions, women's sports and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, sure. You have questions, but make sure that when you're getting answers to those questions or you're being challenged on your beliefs about these things, that you're not just resisting and digging into what you already think, because it's an emotional process to do that. You know, like if you're just like, no, I don't want to have to think differently about this thing. I have my answer and that's it. You know, you're not doing yourself any favors in the long run by having that worldview.
How can people keep up with and support the work that you're doing? It's your website, social media, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So I, hilaryagro.com, HilaryAgro.com is my website. You know, I'm all over Twitter, and I'm on basically every social media platform as Hilary Agro. You can find me on Twitter and TikTok. Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube are my primary things. I do have a podcast that I'm reviving soon. I have a Patreon if anyone actually wants to directly support my work. You know, I'm a working class mother of two. I have two young kids. I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. You know, just keeping my 2-year-old in diapers. You can support me on Patreon, where you have access to like different writings and videos that I do.
Any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Take care of yourselves and take care of each other. I know that the world is really scary right now, but they want us all to be afraid, because when we're afraid, then we're not acting and we're not doing anything to actually fix the problem. So take care of yourself, take care of each other, and learn and grow. And we're all in this together.
Hilary, thank you so much.
Cheers.
That was my conversation with Hilary Agro, an anthropology PhD student at the University of British Columbia and a researcher whose studies include drug policy, activism, and the harms of prohibition. She's also the author of an op-ed entitled In Defense of Drug Dealers' Humanity, which appeared in the April 22, 2023 edition of the Toronto Globe and Mail. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy.
For the Drug
and
Truth
the
Network, this
drugs.
Is Doug McVeigh
For
asking
now,
you to
this is Doug McVeigh
policy
saying
of
so
drug
long.
Prohibition.
So long.
The Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.